Hi, my name is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. This episode is recorded on Wednesday, June 14th, 2017, starting just after 1:13 p.m. in Denver, Colorado, and this is the 111th episode of the show. For more information about how to subscribe to the podcast and help support the production of future episodes by becoming a patron, please visit theastrologypodcast.com/subscribe. In this episode, I'm going to be talking with astrologer Ernst Wilhelm about the doctrine of planetary yogas in Indian astrology. Ernst, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Chris. And it was really wonderful for you to email me and invite me, especially after we haven't seen each other for such a long time.
Yeah, I think the last time I saw you was actually at a Northwest Astrological Conference about 10 or 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And yeah, at the time we talked and sort of compared notes because when we met, one of the things I thought was really interesting about you is that you seem to, in the same way that I tend to go back and have been going back and focusing on the earliest texts of the Western astrological tradition, you've been basically doing the same thing and going back and studying the earliest texts of the Indian astrological tradition for a large part of your career, right?
Yes, pretty much since after the first couple of years, because I just wasn't satisfied with a lot of the modern things. I just didn't feel that it was going deep enough.
Okay. And so you specialize in Indian astrology or Vedic astrology, and this is something you've been studying for 20-something years now, or when did you
studying Vedic astrology in 95, so spring of 1995. So I guess that makes it 22 years now. And the 3 years before that, I was heavily studying Western astrology.
Okay, so you have some background in both, mm-hmm. but you...
You bet.
Made the switch to Vedic astrology, and what was the thing that drew you into that or really appealed to you about it?
You know, what started happening is I was doing the Western, and I could look at the chart, and I could get so much about the person, but I just felt like there was just too much of a mess of a person there to figure out how to really help them. And, you know, I just saw their tangled psychological profile, and I was like, gosh, now what do I do with this? And I wasn't really happy with any of the Western predictive methods. And so when people asked me predictions, I wasn't really feeling confident. And because of just the psychological stuff I was seeing in the chart, it got to where it was so frustrating for me that I couldn't even look at a Western chart without getting nausea. It literally was turning my stomach because I could see all this pain in their chart, all the reasons for their pain, but I didn't know how to deal with it, you know, how to approach helping it. And so I basically quit doing astrology, and I had trained for 3 years with the goal of being a professional astrologer. And within a month of starting my practice, I started having nausea, right? So I just quit, and I had this intuition to go off to an ashram. So I went to the ashram, and after about a month of being there, I had this dream that made me think I should look into Vedic astrology. So I bought this text, the Brihat Parashara, which is one of the, you know, older texts in the sense that it's a recompilation of a very old text. The version we have is only about a little over 100 years old, but it's a recompilation of an old text. And it was like the famous book that I'd heard about. So I went and bought a copy of that, started studying it like crazy. And then, you know, those books are just sutras, and so they're really hard to understand. So after reading through it and just trying lots of things and being really confused, I literally just started sitting down saying, okay, chapter one, write the sutra down, and now let's write about the sutra. And that's when I actually started writing my first book, which was The Vault of the Heavens, where I literally was just trying to figure out what the sutras were meaning, and I kind of did it as a study approach. And then a few years later, I modified it, cleaned it up, and turned it into my first book. So, you know, so I just kind of innocently quit Western and then found myself being more serious about astrology than ever once I stumbled in the Vedic.
Sure. In terms of finding, I think that's the thing that appeals to a lot of people in studying those older forms of astrology is finding a more structured approach and finding more clear-cut rules about what to do and how to interpret different scenarios that you come across. In terms of different chart placements and things like that?
Yeah, it was really nice to have something that felt like, okay, this is really it, you know? Right after that, once I got into the Parashara book, I met a guy in the ashram, and he heard I had done Western astrology. He lived in India for 3 years and studied Vedic there, but he never had a Western astrology reading. So he asked me to look at his chart, and I was like, I don't know, I've been getting nauseous, but okay, I'll do it. So we met one day before lunch, just for a few minutes. We had a few spare minutes in the ashram, and I looked at his chart, rattled off a couple things. And after lunch, he came up to me and he said, you're going to do great in this. You're really good. I just called my mom and had her send all of my books to you and my program. And he had every book in print at that time on Vedic astrology that Wow. was written in the English language, every single book. And so 2 weeks later, I get this big crate from Italy, which is where he was from, which had to cost hundreds of dollars for his mom to ship, you know. And I just started hitting those books. And at first I was so happy because I felt like, okay, this is it. This is the gospel, you know? But as I continued, I started seeing how most of a big portion of what was out there wasn't really the gospel on Vedic astrology. It was just little superficial hits and misses. And after a few years, I realized I really had to focus on those old texts and really try to figure out what was going on with them. And that was actually right after I finished the yogas book. Up until I had done the yogas book, astrology was fun because anything I read, I believed it, you know? But as I got more and more experience, I started finding out how many things were sort of not making sense. As I, you know, started studying more old books and especially the old astronomy books, started seeing how things weren't quite adding up and how a lot of things were being done that weren't in conformity with other books and with the old books and how different old books had different opinions and just how much of a mess Vedic astrology was actually in. When before I thought, okay, this is it in its pure form, which is a nice feeling, you know?
Right.
Unfortunately, it didn't turn out to be true. And over the time, I found that when it comes down to it, there's two systems on which there's a lot of astrology on in India. Well, we could even say three systems. One system is the Tajika system, which is the Persian system that's been preserved in India. It's a lot like the Hellenistic stuff. It's a lot like old Western astrology. It's a great system of astrology. It's great on Prajna or Horary astrology. And they also use solar returns for timing things really accurately. And it's basically Persian astrology that's been preserved in India. So there's a lot of information of that in India. Then there's the system of Parashara. And the system of Parashara has become very fragmented, though. And that system, the main book for that is Brihat Parashara Hora Shastra. And that was recompiled in the late 1800s by a guy who went all over India finding little chapters and bits and pieces of it. So the version we have does have some problems with it, but it's still better than any other text on Parashara astrology that we have from the years previous to that, in the centuries previous to that. And that book it's a great book. It's a profound book, but it doesn't really tell you what to do with things. The majority of that book, the important parts of that book, is it gives you calculations. Like it'll tell you to calculate Ishta and Kashta, the auspicious and illness of a planet, let's say. Okay.
Okay.
And then it tells you to calculate the Cheshta Bala, which is the motional strength and all these different strengths. But it doesn't ever say, all right, now that we've learned to calculate this strength, what you use it for is this. He doesn't say that. Sure. And then he tells us how to calculate out the Avashtas or the conditions of the planets, of which there's five types of conditions, that groups of conditions that planets can fall into. But then he doesn't tell you what to do with those conditions specifically. So you can imagine we've got all these different conditions, all these different mathematical strengths, and we've got about 8 or 9 different things that can go together in, you know, billions of different permutations. You know, it's like a combination lock with 9 numbers on it, and you can turn those numbers in all kinds of ways, right?
Right.
And that's what that book was like. All these amazing calculations, but then trying to figure out what to do with them was a headache. But it's a whole school of astrology. Most of the books in Indian astrology have little bits and pieces that are all found in that book, or they're little bits of pieces of Persian astrology. Some of which are labeled as Persian astrology, but many of which of them aren't labeled as Persian astrology. And of course, many books have a mix of this, especially the North Indian text, where you'll see a mix of the Parashara stuff with some stuff that seems to probably most likely be Persian in origin from long ago. And the Parashara text, what's important about that in the context of our discussion is that that's the book that teaches us actually how to use yogas. Okay.
Okay. So that's the book that you say teaches most us, of the yogas come from?
Not that they come from. There's thousands of yogas in every book, but the most important yogas are found there. But most importantly, the mathematical tools to evaluate the yogas are found in that text. And then finally, there's the Jaimini Sutras book, which is not so much a book of yogas or mathematical techniques. It's a more step-by-step approach to astrology, where you follow a set of rules to arrive at an answer, just using basically planets and signs and houses and a few other things. It's a very simple system of astrology. That book was rediscovered a little over 100 years ago again. We had the first two chapters, the second two chapters were rediscovered a little over 100 years ago. So we have that full text now. It's a very difficult text. While the techniques are really simple, the text is written in coded Sanskrit. So everyone disagrees on how to do most everything in that text because different people are trying to break the code in different ways. And some people aren't, pretty much most people aren't really following the rules of the code breaking specifically as he instructs in the first chapter. Because the first chapter is written in code too, so it's hard for people to figure out how to break the code. So again, with astrology in India, we're kind of confronted with this three sort of main sources, okay? There's the Persian system called Tajika, which is preserved really well, really clearly written. Just take it and use it and wow, okay? Then there's the Parashara system, which is all these calculations, all these conditions or avashtas. And what do you want to do with it? Well, now go spend 10, 20, 30 years figuring out how to put it together. Then we got the Jaimini Sutras, which is step-by-step techniques that a five-year-old could do if you teach them the technique. But written in sutras that, okay, go spend 10, 20, 30 years figuring out what you're supposed to do, after which it gets easy. And then there's bits and pieces of all kinds of systems throughout India. There's bits and pieces of Nadi astrology, of Bhrigu astrology. There's just tons of bits and pieces. And a lot of people these days are trying to focus on these little bits and pieces. But I just ignore those bits and pieces because I think we need systematic astrology, which means Tajika system. Let's learn that. Let's master that. Parashara system. Let's learn that and master that. And then Jaimini system. Let's learn that. Then we have complete systems. And I don't think we should be running around about lots of bits and pieces of systems that which probably, in my opinion, aren't even completely available anymore. You know, maybe one day they'll be recompiled from every little corner of India. But right now we have these three other main systems where we have everything we need right in front of us. We just have to learn to use it and learn to use it better.
Sure. So you published your first book in 2001 and this, your second book was this book called Core Yogas.
Yeah.
And were you drawing on sort of pieces of those different traditions for this book?
What I did in the Core Yogas, I mostly drew on Parashara in the sense of he gives the more important yogas. And yogas are sort of broken down into, we can say, roughly three categories, okay? There's the foundation yogas. And foundation yogas are yogas that are present in the chart, but they have nothing to do with timing. They give a foundation for the person's life. And if a person has strong foundation yogas, everything in their life gets better. If they have bad foundation yogas, everything in their life gets worse, basically, okay? Or isn't as good. So, okay,
and maybe we should back up and actually define what a yoga is first, because okay. I forgot to do that at the start.
Sure.
So what is a yoga, or what does that word mean, and how would you sort of define it if you're trying to teach it to, like, let's say, a Western astrologer?
Okay. Basically, a yoga means union or yoke. Okay, like when you yoke something, that comes from the word yoga. So if you yoke a horse to the carriage, that you're yoga them. Okay, yoga simply means union or yoking. Basically, attaching something in a binding fashion to something. And
okay.
Yogas and astrology are planetary permutations of any type that yoke a person to the fruits of their karma. Okay. So the person has their karma, and it's these planets that yoke them in their different permutations to that, which basically means everything in astrology is a yoga. Okay. Everything in every school is a yoga, roughly speaking, because that whatever you look at in the chart, it's something that's connecting the person to the fruits of their karma. That's connecting them to their fate, basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but any such permutation that's defined, okay, is a yoga in itself. Okay, so if I have Jupiter on an angle from the moon, that's defined as Gajikasara yoga, which will give basically wealth and success and an element of wisdom.
Okay, so a yoga then in that context is not, it's a combination of, let's say, two things, at least in a chart or different chart placements that have specific predicted outcomes, essentially, right?
Exactly. When it's defined as a yoga, it's something that's had an outcome that's been labeled or an outcome attached to it.
Okay. So let's see. So what are some examples? I mean, I know one, I didn't actually see this one in your book, but I remember reading one and I thought it was a Raja yoga, which was like having the ruler of the ascendant in the 10th conjunct the ruler of the 9th house, which is also in the 10th.
Yeah. That's a group of Raja yogas, which are based on angle and trine lords, which are basically, those are derived from Parashara book as well. So, mm-hmm. With yogas, a yoga is essentially anything in the chart that connects a person to the fruits of their fate, which means everything is a yoga. But when we study yogas, we're studying predefined such things. So we're studying combinations that other astrologers have defined as giving a certain effect. And that basically it's a known yoga and was written down at some point. But if you were to look at a chart, and based on your knowledge of astrology, said something, oh, Venus is going to do this to you, you would be defining a yoga right on the spot. Now, a yoga basically is everything in the chart is a yoga. Okay, Venus is doing this. That means it's a yoga for marriage. Saturn is in the 4th house with Mercury and it's killing your pet. Okay, that's a yoga for killing your pet. Is that yoga in any astrology text? Not that I've seen. But if it gives that effect, it's a yoga for that thing, okay?
Sure. And then there's some specific ones that are...
And then there's the defined yogas, okay, which are the ones written down, basically. And in those defined yogas, there's essentially three groups, okay? There's the foundation yogas, which don't have to do with timing. They just create a foundation for the person's life. I cover those in the first half of Core Yogas. And I cover those in a course called Astrology of Character. Then there's what I call the named yogas. These are the most important yogas. Most of these are in Parashara, but we find different versions and some additional ones in other texts. But these are yogas that have specific names, like they might be called Shiva Yoga, Vishnu Yoga. So they might be named after deities. Gajikasara Yoga, which means the elephant lion yoga. You know, there's all these yogas that have specific names. So they'll say, this is this yoga and define it. Those are the most important yogas, and that's why they give them names. And every astrologer should learn those yogas who's interested in predicting wealth or success, because those yogas directly bear on wealth and success. They also give the character qualities of a person that deserves wealth and success, okay? So they give some character qualities, wealth, and success. All the named yogas essentially give those same things. When you read the effects of those yogas, they basically will say it gives you wealth, success, and makes you a good person somehow in different words, okay? But it'll do that in some form. And there's not that many of those. There's somewhat over 200 of those yogas. And so they're really a manageable group of yogas. Like there's something called the wishing tree yoga, a person who gets lucky that, you know, helps them get what they want in life because they have that merit. So all these yogas are what we call dasha dependent, which means they give their effects at certain times in their life. They come into play, they give their effect, then they go away and they come into play and give their effect. So the time when a person gets a new job that doubles his income, that's likely a time where one of these named yogas came into play. Okay.
Right. So these are sort of specific combinations or placements in the birth chart that are sort of lying dormant until they're activated mm-hmm. using the timing technique of the dasha systems, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So they're a very simple way to do astrology. In fact, yogas are the most simple way to do astrology in general. You just learn a planetary permutation. When you see it, you say something about it. And okay, so that's the second group of yogas.
And really quickly, before we move on, one of the things that was interesting, your approach to sort of understanding these yogas is it seemed like you would often look at the Sanskrit term for the name that was given to the yoga, and often that name would be evocative of the interpretation of the yoga. Like one of them was named like a glittering yoga, and it was the ruler of the 11th house, deeply exalted with Venus and in an angle from the ruler of the ascendant. And other combinations like that, where the name actually has some bearing on the interpretation.
Yes. In every case, the meaning of the name of that the yoga is named after is way more important than what they give the effects of. And that's one of the big problems for, you know, people studying yogas these days, is that they read the meanings of the yogas and they're so archaic. They will have three wives, 20 elephants, and lots of wealth and respect by the king. Well, whoever, we don't even deal with kings anymore, right?
Right.
We don't have elephants, you know? It's, so it's like, and so we read through these results that are useless. I think even back then they were mostly useless. What really matters is the name, but the translators never translate the name of the yoga. So they translate the results of the yoga, which even in English don't mean anything useful, and even in Sanskrit don't mean anything useful to us. And the name, which if we think about the name, will actually give us the meaning, the essence of the yoga, they don't translate that. So it's really important to just read the name of the yoga. Like there's a yoga called Kusuma Yoga, which is a blossom. So a blossom, or let's think of a blossom. It's this flower just beautifully expanding into something beautiful, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's the nature of that yoga. When that person's life goes into that Kusuma yoga period, then their life just sort of blossoms. And all of a sudden, beautiful things start happening in their lives. And so that's all we need to know is blossom. We don't need to know anything else, any other result for that yoga. So I'm very much an advocate of just paying attention to the name. Don't even worry about remembering all the results of all these different yogas. It's the name that matters always. It's the key thing.
There's something symbolically significant about the underlying Sanskrit name that you can draw the interpretation from. And that seems common of most ancient forms of astrology, where the interpretation is really embedded in the language.
Yep, totally. And unfortunately, the only book I know of that actually translates the names is the Core Yogas book that I wrote. Everyone else just gives the Sanskrit name and gives the English translation of the Sanskrit results. And so people read those in books and just want to throw them away. And that's sad, because yogas are a great way to do astrology. So the average astrologer learns a handful of yogas instead of really putting them to good use. And these named yogas are invaluable when it comes to try to predict wealth and success and those types of things, the timing periods for those. Without knowing those yogas, people will quite often miss important career times for people. Times when actors win their awards or make their biggest movie. These are almost always indicated by these kind of named yogas.
What are some other names that you feel, or that you use regularly, or that you feel are very evocative in terms of the interpretation that goes along with them?
Okay. Well, if you think of the Gajakasara yoga, that's the elephant lion yoga. It's a very common one. So this person is going to somehow have the qualities of an elephant and a lion. So when we think of that, we think of this elephant, a patient, cumbersome beast, you know, who nothing stands in its way. And if you see an elephant, you can just tell he's used to just doing whatever he wants. And nothing's going to stop that elephant from doing what he wants. But he's not in any rush to get there. And he's not going to go destroy things to get there. You know, he just is going to go and nothing's going to stop him, right? He's just like this force. He's just this invulnerable force. This invulnerable, steady force is basically the image you get when you meet an elephant, you know? and they eat, they take their time, but nothing's going to stop them. They're just an invulnerable, patient force. And then you get the idea of a lion. And a lion, of course, has always been considered the king in all you know, symbolic and symbolism in all cultures. A lion seems to be the king of the jungle, you know, and is attached to nobility and so on. And of course, lions have very good lives. They're taken care of. They're served. They have a whole bunch of female lions. And when they talk about the lion, they're talking about the male lion taking care of them. And they don't have to work that hard, but they get to the top, you know? So at this yoga, these people who have this yoga, they're like that. They get to the top. They know how to let people help them and serve them. Versus some people who get to the top, but they don't know how to have anyone help them in their lives. So they can't really enjoy the benefits of anyone in their lives. Lions know how to enjoy the benefits of people in their lives. So there's people that these people will have good people working for them to make their lives work better. Versus people who get to the top and have success, but who, again, are doing everything themselves, don't know how to benefit from anyone else in their life, you know? They're not going to have a Gajikasara yoga person like that. So that's sort of a basic idea of the qualities with this person. And that quality lets them have success. They don't stop. They keep going. They're impatient. They're courageous, just like the lion is a symbol of courage. And they eventually come to a ruling position or a higher position in life, which is the lion symbology once again.
Okay. Do you remember what the placements are associated with those two yogas?
Oh, that's it. Gajikasara yoga is very simple. It's simply Jupiter has to be on an angle from the moon and aspected by a benefic. So aspected by Mercury or Venus. Some books just say on an angle from the moon, but that happens all the time. And that yoga is, we can consider like a very weak Gajikasara yoga. But simply speaking, it's angle from the Jupiter on an angle from the moon aspected by Mercury or Venus. And All yogas are not created equal. They're always different, okay, in strength. And therefore, the impact they have in each person's chart differs, okay? But that's a very common yoga. I mentioned that because it's one of the first yogas people ever learn in Vedic astrology. It's such an easy one. But then there's other crazy ones. Like there's one called the Chandra yoga. And that's when the Navamsha Lord, the 10th Lord, is on an angle from the moon. And so in that yoga, it's Chandra, which means moon yoga. Well, what's the moon about? Moon is all about receptivity. And so when that happens, a person is able to be open to the best possibilities in their life. And that helps them get ahead in life and move forward in their life. And it's just a really simple yoga. It's relatively common. It's not super rare. So there's just tons of these little yogas that come. But
so that one was the ruler of the 10th house in an angle trine or second from the moon?
The Navamsha Lord of the 10th Lord on an angle from the moon, yeah.
So the Navamsha, so the subdivisional Lord of the 10th Lord?
Yep. So you take your 10th Lord from the birth chart, see what Navamsha's in it, take the ruler of that Navamsha and see if it's on an angle from the moon.
Okay. And the Navamsha, just for listeners that don't know what that is, it's the subdivision of the zodiacal signs that breaks each of the signs up into 9 parts, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, cool. So those yogas are a great, for anyone who wants to predict wealth and success, those are an important group of yogas. Those are the Raj yogas. They're all Raj yogas and they're all wealth yogas. And that's why they're given names. There's lots of wealth yogas and there's lots of Raj yogas. Raj yogas are yogas that give an element of importance or control or responsibility. Wealth yogas give money. These named yogas always give both. Okay. If they're the good ones, which most of them are. And then there's a couple dozen named yogas, which cause problems and which you'll find, like in the charts quite often of, you know, psychopaths, serial killers, people that are impossible to get along with, people who end up being alone and those kinds of things. And a simple one of those is Kapata yoga, which means deceit yoga. And that's when we've got, say, a malefic in the fourth and the fourth lord joined with a malefic. So that means these people will be deceitful. And what the reason is, is they're not always actively deceitful, but they have a lot of issues that they don't know how to deal, that they try to hide from themselves. And in hiding those issues from themselves, they also tend to deceive other people. And when these yogas get extremely negative, you will find them in charts of, like I mentioned, really extremely difficult, impossible people, and even psychopaths.
Okay, that's interesting, because in the Hellenistic tradition, the fourth was also associated with, you know, secrecy and hidden matters, because it's a very bottom of the chart at the most hidden part of the cosmos from the perspective of the observer.
Yes, in Vedic astrology as well, it's what's called a Lina Sthana, which means a concealed house. And the fourth, eighth, and 12th are all considered concealed houses. But definitely, I think the fourth in many ways is the most concealed for the reasons that you mentioned.
Okay. And so this takes us back to the distinction between the three categories of yogas that you started to introduce earlier, right?
Okay.
It's sort of at the foundation of this.
Yeah. So the third category of yogas is basically the everything else category, okay? Where they give tons, I'm talking hundreds of yogas on, that are basically basic effects. So the books will have first house yogas, second house yogas, third house yogas, fourth house yogas, fifth house, all the way to 12th house yogas. And there's literally hundreds of these. For like in the context of in seventh house yogas, 99% of those yogas have to do with relationships and marriage and sexual tendencies and what your spouse might be like. I've compiled about 800 or just under 800 yogas bearing on seventh house matters, relationship-centered matters. And they talk about how many wives a person will have. There's yogas for two wives, one wife, yogas for the wife to die and all this stuff. And some of these yogas are really interesting. Like one yoga is, if Mercury and Venus are in the seventh house, the spouse will die. And I remember at a conference long ago, a person came up and they said, gosh, you know, I was looking forward to this dasha. I thought it would be my best dasha. My love life would really take off. But instead, you know, my girlfriend left me and that was the end of it. And I said, let me look at their chart. Why do you think it was good? They're like, well, I've got Mercury and Venus in the seventh house. And I went into Venus Mercury period. So it should be great. I'm like, no, it's a yoga for losing your partner. When they say die in the old books, it can be often in the US, in the West, where people don't marry for life and, you know, don't have sex with just one person forever. It usually just means their partner is going to leave them or they're going to leave the partner. And so I explained to her that was a yoga for ending relationships. And I remember seeing her years later, like 5-6 years later. And she said, oh, I use that yoga all the time. It works every time, you know?
Interesting. Right. So, and that's really one of the most interesting core things about this is that most of this, it's like some of it seems to be derived symbolically, but other times it might actually be like empirical observations that astrologers made at some point hundreds of years ago and saw it either showing up in enough charts or saw it showing up in a chart and realized why that was the case. And so they gave it a name or they said what the specific outcome was that they observed was associated with it. And then this becomes something that other astrologers later observe and sort of confirm in their practice as well.
Yes. And with these everything else yogas, which are usually given in the books as in step by in house by house arrangement, the big problem with these yogas is the majority of these yogas, like over 90% of these yogas, are just reiterations of basic techniques. If the eighth lord's in your seventh, your spouse will die. Well, any house that the eighth lord is in will usually have a big shift in your life. And you'll have one thing that's replaced by another, okay? So in the seventh house, the eighth lord will shift you from one partner to another at some point, you know, which in India only happened through death, but it's not always through death. It's rarely through death, but it could be. So do we really need to remember that as a yoga? No, that's a basic principle that a good astrologer will know the basic principles, which will cover 90% of what's happening. So 90% of these yogas are just reiteration of basic principles because these yogas, these old books, most of them don't give basic principles. The only book that really is good on basic principles is the Parashara book, and the Faladipika book has some good basic principles. But most of the books from India are just yogas on yogas on yogas on yogas, And you can dredge the principles out of those yogas. And once you've done so, you can throw away over 90% of those yogas. And so then there's only a handful that you need to keep. Like, for instance, I have some yogas courses on my site, the astrologyvideos.com site, where I have, 7th house yogas. And out of hundreds of yogas for giving a spouse or for killing the spouse, for ending the relationship somehow through death or separation, out of more than 100 of those, I've only saved a couple of them that I teach in that course, a handful of them, because those are the only ones that work and which defy standard principles. We should only focus on yogas that defy standard principles. Anything that would be covered by understanding our basic principles, we shouldn't waste our time learning as a separate yoga. And we shouldn't waste ink writing them down even, right? We should write, these are the basic principles. And that's the big part of astrology. Learn your basics. Yogas are the next step. Yogas ideally should be, and these are the things that defy your basic principles. Like Mercury and Venus in the seventh house killing your spouse. That defies your basic principles, you know?
Right.
Another yoga is Venus in the first and the moon in the seventh will destroy your spouse and make you not get, and most likely make you not get married. That defies the basic explanations of what most people learn, you know? And so those yogas are useful if you sort through them and find the ones that are unique and which work. And that's a lot of work that needs to be done on those yogas. I hope to do more work on those in the future, but I have a lot of work to do on all those, literally thousands and thousands and thousands of yogas. There are some real interesting ones. When they get to like ninth house yogas, they give a lot of knowledge centered yogas, how wise the person is. Mm-hmm. And there's a yoga, if the Navamsa Lord or the Lord of the Second Lord is Saturn or Mars, and if it's in an angle or if it's on an angle or trine with malefics, the person will be a master of 6 shastras, which means sciences, will be super intelligent, super wise person. Okay. That's a crazy yoga. The Navamsa Lord of the Lord of the Second Lord has to be Saturn or Mars, and that Saturn or Mars has to be in an angle or trine with another malefic planet. Okay.
Okay, so that's highly, highly specific.
It's highly specific. But I remember one time a person came in and I was just shooting blind on their chart. I just couldn't see anything in their chart. And then I saw that yoga. And I said, gosh, you know, you're a super scholar. You just live for knowledge, you know? He's like, yeah, I'm all about knowledge. I'm studying these health things. And all I want to do with all my time is studying these things. And the thing that makes me happy is learning and studying. And then I also predicted, I said, oh, and also I think you're gay, right? He goes, yep. And because I said those two things, he was so happy with the reading where I couldn't see anything else in the chart, but like those two things, right? And he was so jazzed that over that. So sometimes a yoga will save you when everything else fails. This was long ago in the early days back in 2000. No, this was back in 1998 when I was doing a lot of yoga research and stuff. But yogas are a nice, easy way to do astrology because they sometimes will save you. Like there's a yoga, if the seventh lord's in the fifth, there'll be no children or the spouse will die. Okay? Mm. And I found over time that, and when I say seventh lord and fifth, I don't mean using house cusp. I mean the ruler of the seventh sign from the ascendant is in the fifth sign from the ascendant. Yogas are all done without house cusp for the majority of them. We do use house cusp in Vedic astrology, like they do in Western, but yogas are a technique, but they use full signs in almost every case, okay?
So it's using what Western astrologers would call whole sign houses, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So with this yoga, I remember once I had a student come in and she said, oh, I want you to look at my sister's chart. She's thinking about having another baby. And she was about to go into the dasha, the period, 7-year period of the seventh lord in the fifth. And I said, no, she's not. She won't have a baby with her husband. Instead, she's going to have an affair. Because I just found out that the seventh lord in the fifth tends to get people to get rid of their partner because they have an affair. I just saw it over and over ago. That yoga was constantly creating an affair that led to the termination of their marriage, you know? And she just laughed at me. She just laughed and got up and left, you know? 3 months later, she goes, holy shit, my sister is in love with another guy and having an affair, and she does not want to have a baby with her husband, you know?
Wow.
And so, you know, that yoga saved me. Otherwise, I wouldn't have guessed it. And that same yoga, I remember once a guy came up to me at a conference. He was about to teach a conference. He was teaching on yogas. He goes, I'm going to teach on yogas. I saw you have this book. He goes, this is really interesting. He goes, and I, you know, in yogas, when it comes to yogas, you would never expect the fifth lord, the seventh lord in the fifth, denying children and killing your spouse is one of my favorites. Because it blows astrologers' minds, because in astrology, the fifth house is considered a lucky house. So they think when your seventh lord's in the fifth, you're going to be lucky with love. And I said, yeah, you know, this one yoga, the, you know, seventh lord in the fifth or whatever. And the yoga also works if the fifth lord's in the seventh. He had the, or so the fifth lord in the seventh will do the same thing, or the seventh lord in the fifth. Either way, they give the same thing. So I said, yeah, when the fifth lord's in the seventh, the spouse will die. He goes, really? He goes, you're right. I have that. And in that dasha, my wife, I don't know if she, I remember if she died. He was an old astrologer at the time. She may have died or all they divorced. And so he was like, wow, that's an amazing yoga. Such a simple thing. So those are the yogas we want to learn. But there's only a handful of such yogas that really hit the nail on the head that are unusual. And they're not always there. So we can't always answer the questions with yogas. Because what if the person doesn't have a yoga that we have learned, you know? So it's more important to focus on our basic principles, which are also covered in Brihat Parashara, than all the yogas. Brihat Parashara text does have chapters on first house yogas, second house yogas, third house yogas, and so on. But other books have more of those. The two best books for house by house yogas are Jataka Tattva and Sarvartha Chintamani. Those are the two best yoga books for house by house yogas.
And so basic principles in this context would be things like when the ruler of a house is in a good house or an increasing house, I think it's called like an upachaya house, it indicates like growth or increase or positive things in that area of the life. So that would be like an example of a basic principle instead of a specific yoga, right?
Yes, that's a basic principle. And for instance, if we say the seventh lord debilitated, you'll have three wives. Okay. But do we really need to know that? No, we know that if the seventh lord's debilitated, the person's going to crash and burn on at least one relationship, right?
Sure. So difficulty in relation, the broadest statement you could make is just like difficulties, let's say in the area of relationships, if the ruler of the seventh is debilitated, exactly, or not doing well in the chart.
Yeah. And that's a basic principle. We don't need to learn that as a separate yoga, but that is a separate yoga, you know. But there's another yoga that's more interesting, that if the seventh lord's in the third, in a movable sign, a person will have two wives. So that a movable sign is like what Westerners call a cardinal sign, Aries, Cancer, Libra, and Capricorn. So if the seventh lord's in the third in one of those four signs, a person will have two wives. And what usually happens with that combination, they'll have two at the same time and usually end up having to let go of one. Or if that planet's really strong, they might manage to keep both of them. So they might have an affair and keep both women in their life, or they might have an affair and have two wives. For two wives means they're having sex with two people at the same time. And then eventually they let go of one. But during the period of that planet, they'll be involved with two people at the same time and make the change to one in most cases, from one to the other in most cases. The reason that is because the third house is a house of change. And the movable signs, we call them, you know, they're movable, they change. So you change or move from one woman to the other if your seventh lord is in the third in a movable sign. Pretty simple yoga.
Right. And there's similar delineations in the Hellenistic tradition with the cardinal or the movable signs, based on the idea that movable signs are good at initiating activity, but they're not very good at sticking to it or staying fixed to something in the same way that the fixed signs are.
Yes, exactly. Basic principles, if you really think about it. And, you know, so 90% of yogas we can throw out if we learn the basic principles. The old way of learning Vedic astrology until the 1800s, and by old way, I mean from 600 AD or so to from the middle of the Dark Ages to about the end of the 1800s, the way that people learned Vedic astrology was learning as many yogas as possible. And astrologers used to sit down and literally remember by rote thousands of yogas. And their skill was largely dependent on how many yogas they remembered. So they basically were turning their minds into a computer database of yogas, right?
Right.
And then when they looked at the chart, a yoga would pop out and their intuition would help them the right yoga pop out. And then they'd make a prediction on that right yoga that their intuition helped pull out, and they'd make great predictions. Sri Yukteswar, who was Yogananda's guru, he's famous for being Paramahansa Yogananda's guru, he was an astrologer, and he said learning astrology by memorizing countless yogas is a stupid way to learn it. He goes, we need to learn astrology by learning systematic techniques. He said that in the late 1800s. Around that time, people started wanting systematic techniques, where astrologers started showing up saying, okay, let's do something that's systematic. Let's have a set of rules that we use that covers everything. One of the first people to do that was KP, the KP astrology, the Krishnamurti Padati. And then Iyer came along and developed some techniques, some more systematic technique. The systems approach is one of these systematic systems. All these systems are not equal. Some are better than the others. Parashara has systematic principles in it. It's just no one learned how to use them. Those are the ones that I've spent 12 years working on. And that's about it for people trying to do astrology in a systematic way. But this is what we need to do with astrology. And on top of that, there's these surprises that are to be found in the chart that are defined by all these other millions of yogas. Okay.
Right. That's really interesting how that worked, because that's similar in the Western tradition, just in terms of sometimes it's a different way of learning the approach, what you're describing the way it used to be, where people would, instead of learning the first principles, that you might actually just learn the delineations or the outcomes of like hundreds of different possible placements in their interpretation first, like the specifics. And then from that, they would almost sort of work backwards to the first principles rather than just starting from the first principles and then working forward to all of the hundreds of possible delineations.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a difference from an intellectual approach to a concrete approach. Some people like to learn and are intellectual people, which means they want to understand the why. They care about why. Mm. Okay. And those people, they want to know, why does this work? What's the principle? What's the underlying reason? Those people want to understand the system. But then there's people who just want to know what is. I just want to know what this is. You know, a lot of people, I get so many students like that. They go, I want to know what this is. What does this mean? They don't want to know why it means that. They just want to know what it means to have the fifth lord in the seventh house, you know? And so yogas appeal to those kind of people. And a lot of people are these kind of people who study astrology. They want to know the why. They want to know what's going to happen and when it's going to happen, and they don't care the why. So yogas are really a great way for them to learn. Oh, this equals this equals this. That's all they want to know. And they don't want to be burdened with that attempting to understand some unfathomable technique, which is basically how God is working underneath the surface, which is very profound and difficult to understand, you know?
Sure.
So there's a freshness to learning yogas. It's just fun. You just learn the yoga, you see it, you say it, and you're right. Wow. It's a great way to do astrology. And I was using yogas a lot until 2004. You know, most of my amazing predictions were just based on knowing a lot of these yogas. And I would compile these yogas where I sat down and out of the books, I would type all these yogas in. So I'd spend hundreds of hours typing in to my laptop a yoga database from the stack of old Sanskrit books I had. By the time I had written all those in, a lot of them just kind of sunk in, right? And then other ones I would look for when necessary. So I'd spend a few minutes scanning through yogas. And once you get good at it, you can scan a list of yogas very quickly. And started working with yogas. And eventually when we started making software, we programmed a lot of yogas. But really, for yogas to work effectively, you need to have them in your head. They don't work as good just to have a list that you program and search for. The named yogas work great for that. But a lot of the other yogas, you won't get as good a result as if you actually memorize them. Because when you memorize them, your intuition will pick out the yoga that's going to work for that chart. And you won't remember the other ones. Whereas a computer will ruthlessly pull all the yogas. Some of them might not work in that chart for different reasons. Reasons such as there's contrary things, there's other things going on, there are strength factors that are affecting the whole picture. But the intuition can bypass all that stuff and just grab the right yoga out of the chart. And literally what happens when people learn a lot of yogas, you'll look at a chart and a yoga just literally jumps out at you. And it's the only thing you see in the chart is, like when that lady asked me, is my sister going to have a baby with her? They want to have another baby. What do you think? I just looked at the chart and just that seventh lord and the fifth just jumped out at me and said, I'm the answer, you know? Sure. And I didn't see anything else in the chart. Nothing else in the chart was even apparent to me. And so we need to work with what we have in our heads, what we've memorized and learned, with our intuition guiding us through all the pitfalls of the holes in our knowledge, which there's always going to be, because we're never going to learn every yoga. We're never going to learn every technique that could possibly be arguing against the technique that we do know, you know?
Yeah, you can't memorize all of the millions of different possible just placements and things like that.
And then even if you could, and the old guys, they used to. They literally, I don't know if you've ever seen the Mahabharata. It's this huge Indian epic. These guys used to memorize the whole Mahabharata. It's like thousands of pages of book, okay? And they would memorize it perfectly. And so they had techniques for memorizing stuff where astrologers would literally remember thousands of yogas. But our brains, you know, we don't want to do that with our time, the modern man, you know? But that's the old school. They literally could memorize not only thousands, but millions of sutras. And so it's really amazing what the brain's capable of when we train it.
And that's one of the reasons why a lot of ancient texts, where it was popular, both in the West. I was talking to Benjamin Dykes about this recently, who did a translation of Dorotheus of Sidon from the first century, which was a verse text in Greek, but that was also common in India to versify texts like the Avinajataka, because it makes it easier to remember them if it's in the form of like a poem or almost like a song or something like that.
Yeah, they have Sanskrit meters. There's different Sanskrit meters by which Sanskrit texts are written. I think these meters have somehow been developed to work with how the brain naturally works. Like, as a simple example, phone numbers. We have three numbers, a dash, three more numbers, a dash, and four numbers. It's easy to remember a phone number in 33334 with no more than four numbers at a time than it is to remember seven numbers at a time. And that's why we do it that way. People just found it easier to remember phone numbers as three sets of three numbers that are no longer than four digits a number than it was to remember seven numbers as one set. Because our brain doesn't want to remember seven numbers as one set. It wants to remember up to things and sets up to four. So there are certain ways the brains work that the Sanskrit meters are all based on. Of course, once we translate those to English, there's no meter left and it's kind of hopeless, right? It's a lot harder to memorize.
That's kind of unfortunate that we're losing that piece of it when we translate it into English, yeah. That it's not going to like rhyme and have that. Because that actually makes them even more interesting in terms of that memorization component, is realizing that all of these are things that are being memorized because they rhymed and were in verse and had that sort of component to them. It would almost be nice to attempt to create a new set. I don't know if anyone's done that, a new set of yogas or rules like that that did rhyme or had that memorization component in English.
Totally. It would be a really great thing for someone who's poetic to take the yogas, take astrology principles and write them out in poem. I actually thought that would be fun to do at one point, you know, so that we could just sing a little song to ourselves, you know, and in our minds as we read a chart and make it easier. Because it is hard to memorize the way that we write things down in English. It's very hard.
Right. And except it would be for specific things like that. You know, if the ruler of the fifth is in the seventh, then blah, blah, blah. Yeah, that would be really interesting. Well, so bringing things back around a bit. So with the different yogas, there's, you know, placements. And one of the reasons I thought that I wanted to say this episode would be interesting to do is because even though on the one hand, as you said, yogas are just, you know, any placement or any combination, I think this is a easy, this is an approachable topic for Western astrologers to approach Indian astrology because of some of the more complex yogas where you do have, you know, multiple placements or multiple combinations of placements. And then there's a specific delineation because it shows you the approach to chart synthesis that's available in Indian astrology. And there's something appealing about that, I think, to Western astrologers, because chart synthesis is often something that's kind of lacking or not very well defined in modern Western astrology.
Yeah, it's not well defined for sure, but I think I totally agree. It's something Western astrologers could use these. They could use 70-80% of them right away. Only a few of them would have things that are strange to Western astrologers.
Sure. So like one of those, I think, is in Indian astrology, I think like the voice is associated with the second house, right?
Yeah, voice speech is associated with the second house, yes.
Okay. Whereas they might, I don't know, they might associate that with the third house or whatever.
Yeah, or Mercury, yeah. But I'm talking about most things that have the same houses. So I think Western astrologers could follow most yogas that they came across.
And that's actually a point where you have a similar approach that would make this more approachable or easier for a lot of people, because you actually are unique in your personal practice where you use, even though you practice Vedic astrology, you use the tropical zodiac, right?
Yeah. You know, what happened is, as I started studying the old texts, especially the old astronomy books, I started realizing that the Indian astrologers around 500 AD had no idea whether they were using sidereal or tropical. They didn't even know. Because they make statements that show that they had lost the knowledge of the precession of the equinoxes. Even in the philosophical books, even in the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is one of the key philosophical books from India, they show that when that book was written, they did not have knowledge of the precession. And of course, the precession is what makes the tropical and sidereal zodiacs different. Mm-hmm. And there's more things in the astronomy books that point towards them using tropical, even though they didn't know that there was a sidereal. They didn't differentiate at that time. And the Srimad Bhagavatam was voiced probably around 900 BC, but it wasn't put down to writing in the version we have until about 700 AD or so, I believe. And by at that time, the Indians did not know. We know for sure from the writing of Yavana Jataka, which is about 50 AD, that book shows that they did not know of the precession of the equinoxes. And then around 550 AD, we've got Varaha Mihira in his astronomical book showing that he was not aware of precession. And then Aryabhatiya in 599 or end of the 500s, I think Aryabhatiya was around. He's the person that Western civilization got a lot of their mathematics from. He was an astronomer. He alludes to tropical more, but you can tell he's not making a statement. And so there was not this idea that there was really two definable zodiacs at least until 599 AD. We don't know when this idea of two zodiacs came into place. And what's really interesting, at that time period, the first 600 years, all the texts, first 650 years till about the 7th century, the astrology texts we have from that time period don't use Vimshatri Dasha. Instead, they use dashas that are more like, you know, Ptolemy's terms. So they're more like Greek dashas, actually.
So like primary directions or something like that?
No, maybe? Not directions. Where basically you find the strongest planet on an angle, and that becomes the lord of the first term or the first dasha.
Right.
I don't remember this much, but if you get some of the old Western books, like the Greek books, like I don't even know if Manilus is Greek. I'm way out of my terms here. But there's that book Manilus, and he has terms in it. Are you familiar with that book?
I think what you're talking about sounds kind of like the approach to the length of life technique, and they had a time lord or a dasha system
built
into that.
All the books we have from that time period up until the 6th through the 7th century use that kind of time system. They don't use Vimshatri Dasha.
So where, when does that, that shows up?
And then after that, the books after that, there doesn't seem to be a lot of books from the 7th century until about the 12th century. Then we start having some 12th century books. Okay. We do have some commentaries on some old books, written in the 11th century, I believe. So we don't really have a whole lot until about then. Okay. Those books start emphasizing Vimshatri Dasha. So, and now Vimshatri Dasha is based on the moon's position in its nakshatra, which is a sidereal phenomenon. Mm-hmm. The other dashas of terms that are more term, like the Greek, some of the, I don't know, old Western stuff, Manilis and so on.
Right.
Those dashas are all based on signs, of course. And the base, this dasha length is determined to a large degree by how far the planet is from exaltation, which is determined by its sign. So I think what happened is the astrologers were using the tropical zodiac, but didn't know there was a difference between sidereal, but there was. So they couldn't get from 100 to 700 AD or up until 700 AD from about 0 AD, they couldn't get Vimshatri Dasha to work, because they were calculating the nakshatras tropically and they couldn't get it to work. Then they started realizing that there was something called precession towards the end of the 500s. And they slowly started realizing that, wait a minute, there's two zodiacs, and they followed the sidereal. Once they started following the sidereal zodiac, the dashas of terms, you know, quit working. But the dasha based on the moon's nakshatra, which is sidereal, was working. So after that, we see Vimshatri Dasha, Vimshatri Dasha, and we don't see any sign-based dashas. In Jaimini system, it's all sign-based dashas. Some Jaimini techniques are preserved in some of the older Parashara books, but no sign dashas, no sign-based timing systems were preserved. All of those are in Jaimini, though. Jaimini is completely sign-based. And so I think that Vimshatri became the popular dasha because it was a sidereal-based dasha, because it's based on the nakshatras, the stars, not the rashis, the signs, which were tropical. So when I started seeing all this, and I started seeing how these astrologers, up until the 7th century, had no idea whether they were using tropical or sidereal. But based on what they say, there's more evidence they were using tropical, but thought they were using sidereal when they started noticing a separation, when they started noticing the stars moving from the vernal equinox, at which point they kept following those stars and developed the sidereal system that they kept using. So then I, after seeing that, I started testing everything, and I spent 2 years not telling really anyone. I kind of told some of my closest associates in astrology what I was working on, that I was working on the, you know, testing the tropical, and that it seemed like it could be very valid. But otherwise, I really kept it to myself, and I tested every technique I knew for 2 years. And statistically, every technique tested out better on the tropical zodiac. So then I programmed some really simple things, like Saturn-Mars conjunctions tend to break things. So I programmed some of these simple things, and I programmed them in sidereal, with Lahiri Ayanamsha, which is the most commonly used Ayanamsha, with tropical plus 30 degrees. So we take the tropical position and add 30 degrees, and a completely random Ayanamsha, where every chart would just randomly pick a number between 0 and 160 and use that as the sidereal correction, and created a sidereal zodiac out of that random correction or Ayanamsha. And then, so I created I programmed several simple things. And then I had about 700 people who went to this website I built for it. And based on their chart, it would give them four answers based on these four different calculations. So tropical tested out best in every single technique we programmed. The next best was tropical plus 30 degrees. After that, the sidereal zodiac tested out the very same percentage as a random zodiac, as randomly picking a number between 0 and 360. So I think when people are using a sidereal zodiac, they might as well just pick any number and any INM ship makes no difference because they had the exact same percentage of results as a random INM ship. So after finishing that test, I finally let everyone know I was only using Tropical, that the sidereal tested out badly in my own tests and on tests on 700 people. Every time the Tropical beat the sidereal. So at that point, I just stopped doing the sidereal, never looked back.
Okay. And that's interesting just in terms of the historical bit, because there was a lot of, not controversy, but there's a lot of confusion in the Western tradition for the first few hundred years as well.
Yeah.
Between like the first century BCE and the fifth century CE, basically, where the astrologers, it's not really clear that even though precession had been discovered by Hipparchus, most of the astrologers don't seem to have been aware of it. And it's not clear that they understood what zodiac that they were using or that there was a difference between the two.
Yep. And then there was a group of people in the first century in Greece who were putting the vernal equinox at 8 degrees Aries.
Right.
I don't know why they did that. Maybe because they figured the Earth tilts at approximately 22 degrees, you know, to the ecliptic. And so they, or the ecliptic's at a, you know, an angle to the Earth. So they took off 22 degrees from Taurus. I don't know what they were thinking, but there's, Ptolemy talks about it, that there's astrologers who are using sidereal, tropical, and 8 degrees Aries on the vernal equinox. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, I mean, it was just based on inheriting an old value from the Mesopotamian tradition from like hundreds and hundreds of years earlier that was no longer relevant.
And then they used it in a fixed fashion instead of a changeable faction. So they were using a sidereal zodiac that was accurate in the past, but not in that time.
Yeah, or something like that, or a blended one.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, so a lot of funny things have been happening during that time, yeah.
Yeah, just it's like we take precession for granted now, but you have to like go back into a time period in which that's just like a theory. I mean, it's probably not a good analogy, but you could almost put it like global warming or something like that, where if it was like 100 years ago and people took it as like a theory that this is something that's happened, but if it hadn't been demonstrated or proved or something yet, where it's like a scientific theory that like some people accept and other people reject and say, no, you know, maybe that's just a side effect of something else.
Yeah, something like that. And I think one of the problems we've always had in astrology that we have, you know, people talking about in the old Indian books is astrologers not learning their astronomy.
Right.
And that's been happening where there's one group of people who, even in India, they call them the Panchanga makers, the people who make the ephemerises, and they don't practice astrology. And then there's astrologers who practice astrology and have no clue how to make an ephemeris, you know? And we've had that division in the West, and we've had that division in India too. And, you know, and so I think when the astrologer doesn't even understand astronomy, it's really easy for things to start going in an incorrect direction. And then you look back and 1,000, 2,000 years have passed and people are doing things that absolutely make no sense. In India to this day, they celebrate the northward movement of the sun on January 14th.
On January. So that's an old value for like
the sun never moved north on January 14th. It always does it on December 21st. It's a tropical motion, right?
Right.
But they associate the moving of the sun north, not with the actual movement of the sun. They associate that when the sun enters Capricorn. And since they calculate Capricorn sidereally, it happens January 14th.
Okay, right.
And I've talked to people and I've said, no, it's already moved north for 3 weeks. They go, no. And know what they told me? They said, maybe in the rest of the world, the sun moves north on January 21st. But in India, the sun doesn't move north until January 14th. That's what people have told me in India, you know, that I've argued this with. That no, in India, the sun moves north 3 weeks later than the rest of the world. That's how bad their astronomy is, you know? Sometimes.
Yeah, that's always been a tricky issue and a hotly debated issue in all, you know, many astrological traditions in terms of the zodiac issue. But I guess just the important point here is just that when you're using yogas, you're using pole sign houses and you're using the tropical zodiac, so that it effectively you're using an approach that's very similar to like my approach, for example, in Hellenistic astrology, where I'm also using the tropical zodiac and whole sign houses, even though some of the qualities that we might attribute to the houses or to the signs might be slightly different.
Yes, perfect. Yeah, the yogas will just fit right in that, what you're doing.
And then in terms of the timing techniques, so one of the principles with some of these yogas is that they indicate, you know, certain outcomes or certain predictions that are sort of built into the chart, but that they're lying dormant until they get activated by the dasha systems, which are the equivalent of like the Hellenistic Time Lord systems. And what dasha systems do you use at this point in order to determine the activation of some of these yogas?
For yogas, you want to use the Vimshatri dasha.
Okay.
Vimshatri dasha works fantastic with yogas. It's definitely the dasha to use for that.
Okay. Yeah. And that is, as you were talking about earlier, the most widely used dasha system, I think, amongst Vedic astrologers, right?
Yes, by far the most widely used. A lot of people think that's the only one that exists. That's how popular it is. Yeah.
Okay. And do you sometimes employ other ones, or is that your main not one
for
still as well?
Not for using yogas. For yogas, that's the only dasha I use.
Okay. Got it. And let's see, other things. Oh yeah, one other thing I meant to touch on is that, so you have, it's like sometimes these are straightforward because you have different categories or different breakdowns of like auspicious yogas or inauspicious yogas or mixed yogas. But then there's also mitigating conditions sometimes for some of these yogas where there can be a mitigation if there's a certain placement that's intervening, or sometimes if you have two different yogas taking place at the same time, can they cancel out or mitigate each other in some sense?
Okay, yeah. So there's a lot of things going on with yogas. And most planets are going to be involved in many yogas, okay? First of all, to complicate the issue. So it's not always a straightforward thing. Then also, a yoga is almost always involved with more than one thing. So if you're running the Mercury period and it's creating a yoga with Venus, in Mercury Venus, you'll get that yoga in full. But if you're running Saturn dasha and you go into the sub period of Venus, you're running Saturn Venus, you're not going to get those effects of that Venus yoga that you got in the Mercury period. So it has to be taken into context of the other planets involved in the yogas and the periods that a person's actually in at any given time. That's one big thing, okay? Then a planet is always doing so many things. He's given the effects of his yogas, then he's given the effects of his conditions, and then he's given the effects of his houses to his best ability. Those three things might all line up. They might all be contrary, or they might just be completely different things. So if those three things line up, you're going to get an extreme case. So if you get something that says you'll be poor, a yoga that says you'll be poor, and that planet is also the ruler of your second house, which is in your eighth house with Saturn and Rahu, or with Saturn in the north node, then you know that they're going to get a beating to their wealth. So then we have two things pointing in the same direction. And then three things, because at that point we've got the ruler of the second in the eighth, which is difficult. And then we stick it with Saturn and Rahu, that puts it in a bad condition. So
there can be like intensifying conditions that make it worse.
Yeah. So you've got everything going against wealth during that time. So wealth is going to be disastrous. Okay. But let's say a person has got, the second lord in the eighth house, which is going to cause a break to wealth, some setback to wealth. But then let's say the second lord is in what we call a delighted condition, a condition of happiness. Then we're going to have a break and also something good. So we're going to get two things, and we're going to get whatever the effects of the yoga is too. And the yoga may not even bear on wealth. It might be a yoga that bears on something else. So in that case, when two things are showing different things, you usually get, if two things are showing contrary things, you'll get two things of opposite nature that usually end up creating a balance. So you get $100, but then you lose $100. Okay.
Sure. Yeah, that's often a question I have about some of those placements, because I've seen it sometimes go both ways. And so you have a question of, does it cancel out, or do you just get both sort of simultaneously, or one after the other?
You usually get both at somewhat different times, okay? Because usually the thing that's causing the contrary is something else. So let's say I got the moon, and it's the second lord, and it's with Saturn. That means moon is starved. So the moon is going to starve their wealth. But then let's also say that the moon is aspected by Mercury, his friend. Now the moon's delighted. So we have a moon that's both starved and delighted. So when they're in moon dasha and they go into the sub-period of Saturn, their moon's going to be starved. They're going to struggle for wealth. But in the next dasha, after Saturn, they'll be in moon. From moon Saturn, they'll go to moon Mercury. In moon Mercury, the Mercury delights the moon and their wealth comes back. So in moon period, they both starved for wealth and they're delighted in wealth. They get both things at different times. But
okay.
So, but let's say that we had a yoga where both planets were causing this, both, say both moon and Saturn were causing a yoga for wealth and a yoga for losing wealth, and no other planet was involved, but it's just them. Then in moon Saturn, they would mitigate each other and you would maintain the status quo on average. But really what you would have to do, you'd have to evaluate the two contrary yogas and say, okay, the moon is giving, moon and Saturn are giving wealth for this reason, but they're taking wealth for this reason. Which reason is stronger? And then we can compare which one's giving more, which one's taking more to find out if some, if the end is more or less than where they're at going into that period. So we can mathematically evaluate those contradictions as well.
Okay, that makes sense. So, and part of the, so that's important. And then part of the other important underlying sort of notion or core principle here is that the yogas indicate certain outcomes, but that these can be modified for better or worse based on things like sign placement, aspect to the yogas, and other things like subdivisional placement and things like that, basically,
well,
right?
Yeah, basically, you're going to get that yoga, and you're going to get that yoga to the strength of the yoga, but you're also going to get everything else that that planet's doing. You're going to get what it's doing as a house lord, which may compensate for what it's doing as a bad yoga. So every planet's going to be different. Then you're also going to get what you're getting in the divisional charts from that planet. So maybe in the divisional charts, the planet's really good in wealth, but it's in a bad yoga for wealth. So now we've got something showing contrary effects. And the astrologer has to say, okay, what's making it give good money in the Varga, in the divisional chart? When that thing comes up, it'll give money. But when this yoga comes up, it'll give bad. So a planet is always doing multiple things. And we have to evaluate all those intelligently. And that's just part of learning the Vedic astrology. But you can be pretty accurate just using yogas if it works with your intuition. Let me give you an example. That's why I say we don't want to, if we program yogas and we just search through them, other than the named yogas, we'll just make a confused mess of the reading. We have to learn the yogas. And then when we look at a chart, a yoga pops into our head. Like for instance, back when I was first studying astrology, I did everything on donation. And I had a reading, I printed out the chart and I looked at the chart and I said, wow, this person's wealthy. I'm going to get a great donation today. And I was starving to death in my first day. So a big donation was really what I needed, you know?
Sure, sure.
And so, but just 2 days before, I'd read a book. And in that book, I read a yoga that said, if the Navamsha Lord of the Moon or the Navamsha Lord of the Lagna Lord is in the 12th, a person will be poor. And I looked at her chart and I said, oh, she's going to have so much wealth. And all of a sudden, this idea came, look for that yoga that you just read about 2 days ago. Hmm. And I looked and she had the Navamsha Lord, which is the D9 divisional Lord of her moon and of her ascendant Lord, both in the 12th. So she had that yoga twice, right? And that means they'll be poor. So when she came in, I said, you've been to other astrologers before, right? She goes, yeah, I've been to a lot. I said, and every one of them said, you are fantastically wealthy, right? She said, yep. They all said I was really wealthy. And I said, and when you said that you weren't wealthy, they all said one day you'll be really wealthy, right? She goes, yep. They all said that when I said that. I said, well, I'm here to tell you, you're never going to be filthy wealthy.
Just because of that, based on that
yoga. Because of that yoga. It was a double whammy. And she was so happy. She said, oh, I'm glad to hear that because I don't care about money. I don't have making money as a goal at all. And when those astrologers told me I was supposed to be wealthy, I was wondering if I was doing something wrong every time I hear that. So I'm really relieved to hear that I'm not going to be wealthy. And I'm totally good with that, you know? So
my intuition decided to just look up this yoga in this person's chart. If my intuition hadn't said, look for this yoga, I would have botched that whole reading. I would have been like every other astrologer she went to. I would have said, you're really wealthy, right? You've got so much money. And she would have said, no. And I would have said, well, one day you'll be wealthy. And she would have said, oh, maybe. And I would have been absolutely wrong. So yogas need to work with their intuition. Memorize them, learn them, and look at the chart and see what jumps out at you. And if they jump out at you, then you can trust them. Then you know you don't need to learn. Look at all the other 100 things that could be getting in the way of the yoga. If your intuition seizes on that yoga, you won't have any choice but to say the results of that yoga and you'll be right. If you try to intellectualize it though, then you can start looking at all the possibilities. Next thing you know, you'll be pulling your hair out and not make a good prediction. So we have to use our intuition with yogas. It makes it a lot easier.
Yeah, that makes sense. So it's not just this mathematical thing where you're, you know, adding up point scores or doing something statistically, but for you, there's this other component to it that has to do with sort of the intuition or the practice or the things that come up in the process of reading a chart.
Yes.
That are kind of unique in that moment in some sense.
Yes. And the truth is we can do it all mathematically. I could do it all mathematically. I know enough to do it all mathematically and precisely. But I'll tell you, it's going to be so much work and so painful. No one will be able to pay me enough to go through that. It's too intellectually painful to work on a reading on 100% intellectual level. So if the intuition is saying, here I am, listen to me, I'm the yoga you got to talk about, I'm going to talk about it to save myself an hour's worth of work, you know?
Sure.
Painful, drudgerous work. But when it comes to researching, no. When it comes to researching and testing statistically, that's all very brutal, statistical, methodical work, you know?
Okay, so that's sort of the difference between sort of the research into the techniques and establishing which ones work the mm-hmm. most versus just the process of doing a consultation and
yes.
the unique setup of a client, an astrologer, and the unique basis of that consultation at that specific moment in time.
Yes. And the good people who do good readings are people who listen to what's happening during the reading and respond to what they see in the chart, not intellectual people. If we over-intellectualize a reading, a person will get lost in the woods really fast, you know? Because there's not enough time in a reading to pour through things. You just got to get into the flow and trust your higher self, your intuition, whatever you want to call it, to see in the chart what needs to be seen and to see the things that are happening, even though, yes, there's always something contrary. But being able to listen to that feeling of, yes, I can see this other thing getting in the way, but this is actually what's going to happen. Because the bottom line is everything in the chart is contradictory. There's always so much contrary stuff going on in a chart, and trying to measure all that all the time is really painful. Sometimes you have to. When I do a reading, I just go with the reading and I see what happens. The intuition and just the knowledge that's in the astrologer combined with their intuition will get a lot of the reading done. After that initial part of the reading, the person might ask something that the astrologer just didn't see. At that point, the astrologer has to look and see if they see it. And if they don't, then they got to get busy with real astrology, with scientific, hard ass, crunch the numbers, methodical, don't miss anything astrology to work it out. And that's hard. That means that question takes 20 minutes to answer versus the question that just comes out of this, just is so visible to the astrologer for some reason, takes 1 second to answer.
Sure. And that's probably in the long term. It's like people often ask me about, you know, why can't you just plug all of this stuff into a computer and have it spit out a delineation? And one of the issues computers have is chart synthesis on the one hand, and synthesizing the thousands of different placements that are sometimes contradictory, and knowing how to yep. weigh different ones, but also probably that third component that you're talking about, which is the thing that arises in the moment sort of spontaneously from the consultation.
Exactly. And until a human gets smart enough to know astrology perfectly enough, they won't be able to program a computer to do it, because the computer
sure.
is only going to use the techniques as scientifically as the astrologer. And the truth is, most techniques we use aren't scientific enough in the context of perhaps just not being that good, but also in the context of especially everything else that's going on, you know? we can look at a chart and grab one thing out of the chart and make a prediction, but a computer's going to look at everything. And what astrologer looks at everything that's really happening and can synthesize everything in a reading. Sometimes we have to do that, but the most of a reading is not that. Most of the reading is just somehow knowing the right thing to talk about and ignoring something else.
Right. And that actually might provide a nice segue to the final point that I wanted to touch on before we wrap up, which is just there's one class of yogas that you talk about actually very early in your book that has to do with all of the planets in the chart being in certain placements. So like one of them was all of the planets being in fixed signs, for example, or there's one where all of the angular houses are occupied by benefics, or there's another class where there's certain chart patterns that are formed in the chart that's sort of similar to the modern 20th century Western idea of planetary patterns, essentially.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And anyone who's into planetary patterns really needs to learn those, what are called Nabhas yogas. The most interesting ones are the Nabhasa Akriti yogas, which are the more planetary patterns. I know Western astrologers tried working on that, you know, in the early days, in the 40s, you know, like the Mark Edmund Jones worked on that in the book where he talks about the bucket formation and all this. That stuff is a complete joke compared to the Nabhas yogas. If you want to learn planetary patterns, the Nabhas yogas will blow your mind. They're the real planetary patterns. I think people have been trying and struggling, but these are the old ones from the enlightened guys. These Nabhas yogas are shown in all the important old astrology books, but nobody uses them. Nobody knows how to use them until I wrote about them in the Core Yogas book, but they're absolutely amazing yogas. And in fact, I have one student from long ago who has a busy practice, and pretty much all they use is Nabhas yogas and compatibility. And they specialize in relationships. And without those Nabhas yogas, they don't feel like they can do a proper job for their clients. They're super important foundation yogas. I cover those in the Astrology of Character course, and they're also in the first part of that Core Yogas book. But those are amazing yogas. Those are the first yogas given in the Parashara text. And they're just really neat. They are important planetary yogas. Like the yogas, when the majority of planets are falling from the fourth to the seventh house, is the Arrow Yoga. And these people... Okay. You know, well, are ruthless people. They go for what they want. Nothing gets in their way. They ride over anyone they want something. They'll kill people. In the old days, they say they'll kill people to get what they want, you know. And you'll find these people just tend to be sharks a lot of the time. And if they're passive people, they could be passive sharks. But they're very intent. They need to have their desires met. It's just, they just have a burning need to have their desire met. They don't understand how they can have any happiness until their desire's met, and their desire becomes the biggest thing in their life. It's a very difficult foundation for people to have. And I learned the importance of this yoga once when I was at a conference, and there was an astrologer there who had this powerful chart, you know, the chart of everything, so powerful, exalted this and this and that, super powerful chart. And so many, but he was having like conflicts with everyone there, not with me, because I managed to avoid conflict, but every other person there, this guy was having some conflict with. And like during his classes, he was actually insulting other astrologers who were at the conference, like just shooting arrows into him, you know? He came and asked me to look at his chart. And I said, oh, you've got the fifth lord in the seventh. So you haven't had good luck in marriage. He had that yoga, by the way, it was funny. And he said, yeah. But I noticed he had this arrow yoga. And I said, oh, that's why you're not getting along with anybody. Such a beautiful chart in every way, but this arrow yoga. And it really explained a lot of the problems he was having with other guys. In fact, the astrologer he insulted went up to him after the class and almost beat him up in the corner of the conference room is how pissed he was at him, you know?
Wow.
So you know, so these yogas are really important.
So that's an example of one where it's all the planets or most of the planets in the chart are between the fourth and the seventh house. And then other ones are like, you know, all of the planets in the bottom half of the chart below the horizon, or all of the planets in the top half of the chart, or other things like that, right?
Yep. So when they're all the planets, well, and there has to be a chain. You have to, there's basically 20 patterns, and you have to find the pattern that the chart follows most closely. And you only use the seven planets, Sun through Saturn. You don't use outer planets. You don't use Rahu and Ketu. And some charts will just follow one pattern perfectly. That's really rare. Most charts will follow two or three patterns imperfectly, and they'll follow those the same imperfectly. They'll have a mix of those patterns. Then some people will just have one pattern that they follow imperfectly, and that's the only pattern you have to consider. So you have to study all 20 and say, okay, which of these 20 patterns does this chart most closely follow? And that's the one they are. If they have more than one pattern that they follow the same closely, say there's two patterns where six planets follow perfectly and one planet doesn't follow the pattern, then they have those two planets equally. Then they're going to have a mix of those planets. And that's what I always often find people who've got, you know, a lot of people come in to get an astrology reading have hard lives, you know. Well, when they have hard lives, usually you have a tough pattern, you know. But they'll usually also have one or two good patterns that's trying to help them get away from that tough pattern, you know. So I just see so often one good pattern and one bad pattern or two good patterns and one bad pattern to the people actually come in who've got tough lives, you know. And so the person struggling with those patterns and trying to go towards the good. But it really helps to understand these patterns, like the, you know, if we have like the yoga where all the planets are going from the first or seventh, the ideal yoga, the perfect pattern is one planet in the first, one in the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh. So a perfect chain of planets. That's the boat yoga. And these people basically, they're very emotionally dependent on everything. Everything is in, they're very need-centered. And they're so need-centered that the smallest need not being met causes them to rock the boat and tip the boat. So if you're dating a person like that, the day you can't be there for them, that they need you, they just won't be able to hold it together. And they'll be so upset for you and you'll be making up for it for a month, you know? So there's so much need in that person to have the external fulfilled that they're hoping for, that when it's not met, they very easily get depressed and upset. And so you can't really be happy with those people, you know, because they can't be happy in a reasonable relationship or in a reasonable job or whatever. Okay. So that's one of the patterns, you know. But then there's like the parasol yoga, the umbrella yoga, when we have a chain from the seventh to the 12th house of seven planets. And that's, a great combination. Those people can just go through hell and back and hardly a drop of hot lava lands on them thanks to their umbrella, you know? And so when these people have hard lives, when there's a good pattern, like the parasol yoga, they grow out of that and they grow past it. When people have bad patterns, the hard things in their lives are more devastating. So if you get two people and both people had their parents die when they were four, and one person has a good pattern, they're growing out of that. They're going past all that trauma somehow. Whereas the person with the bad yoga, you know, that trauma is just the reason, the excuse, whatever you want to call it, for making every bad decision they can possibly make. So you can really, with these patterns, you can see if people are going in a direction of greater health, no matter what difficulties are shown in their chart, or if they're going in the direction of just, you know, making life hard for themselves. Even when they do have some other great things in their chart. So it's a foundation of the chart. If it's a foundation that's solid that they can build on, or if their foundation is kind of like quicksand, that every good thing eventually is just going to sink into the quicksand.
Sure. And you said that these most of these planetary pattern ones don't involve the nodes, Rahu and Ketu.
None of them do.
But there are some other yogas elsewhere in the book that do. I think they're called Kalasarpa yogas that involve the nodes, Rahu and Ketu,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, there are some yogas that involve Rahu and Ketu. Most of the important yogas don't involve Rahu and Ketu, though some of them do. These Nabas yogas are only the seven visible planets because it's the pattern. It's the visible pattern. You got to be able to look out your window and see the pattern in the sky, actually.
Right. Yeah, because that would be striking. For example, with the parasol or the umbrella one you were just talking about,
sure.
You know, if theoretically at least you could look up and see, you know, six planets or seven planetary bodies literally going across the entire sky.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it'd be a beautiful
right.
night. And sometimes when that stuff happens, you know, NASA will put out a bulletin. Oh, there's an amazing thing. There's seven planets all lined up in a perfect arc across the semi-arc across the sky. And it's good if it's the arc hits the right place, you know? But if it's from the first to the seventh, it's difficulty. But from the seventh to the first, it's going to be a nice time to be born.
Sure. All right. Well, I think that covers, we've covered a lot of ground today. Yeah. So this was a great conversation. Thanks a lot for coming on. What if people wanted to learn more about planetary yogas, where could they go and what else could they learn, or what do you offer in terms of teaching this?
Sure. I have the Core Yogas book, which I wrote back in 2002. That's available. And I did that with the Sidereal Zodiac. I was still using Sidereal Zodiac at that time. So you can learn it, but then apply it tropically if you get that book. But the yogas are all there. You can look up all the yogas. You can read about the yogas. You can understand all the yogas from that book. But I recommend doing all of them in tropical, not sidereal, the way the examples are done in the book. Then also,
and that's available as a PDF on your website,
it's
right?
It's a PDF, yeah. Then I've also got a course called Astrology of Character, which covers all the foundation yogas, including those Nabas yogas. That was done in sidereal. That was done in like 2001, I think, before the book even came out, or 2002 when the book came out. It's an old course. Then there's a course called Parashara's Formula for Yoga Judgment. That course, I basically teach how to use all the timing-dependent yogas and all the named yogas and the Raj yogas, which are really important because we didn't even get into that. But the Raj yoga system, there's this idea that certain planets become good or bad depending on the houses they rule. It's a very important concept that's vastly misused in Vedic astrology that really shows a lot of the core of the person, and which are also timing dependent. So I cover those yogas in detail in that course. In that course, I also show the way I use to mathematically evaluate the yogas. In the book, I use something called Shubha, Ashubha, and Mishra yogas, which means auspicious, inauspicious, and mixed yogas. Those are from Satya Jatakam, written by an old book attributed to an ancient sage and master of astrology who had his own system of astrology. At that time, that was the best tool I could find to evaluate the yogas. They're sort of yogas within themselves. They're just a principle by which you can judge any planet based on several factors, sort of like a holistic principle. So I was using that to judge yogas back then. But since then, due to all the work with the Parashara text, I now use something called Shubha, which means auspicious, Ashubha, which means inauspicious, Ishta, which means the desired, Kashta, which means the sick, the diseased, and the directional strength of the planet to evaluate the yogas. And I teach that in the course, but not in the book. So I recommend the course more than the book if you want to learn how to mathematically evaluate the yogas. But for the foundation yogas and just to learn the yogas, the book is great. And the book is great just as a reference to the yogas, to be able to search them and find them and things like that. Okay.
Yeah, I've been reviewing the book over the past while now, and it's just a really great resource because you list, I think it's like 250 yogas where you're actually drawing from the different texts and compiling all of them from a bunch of text. You have, I think it's 250, right?
I think it's 240. It's right around there. Yeah, 240 some, I think, right around there.
Okay. Yeah, so it's just a really great resource for anyone who wants to get into this topic. And it's really, you know, reasonably priced because you can just buy the PDF right from your website and then it's downloadable right after that.
Yeah, and I do hope to get that into print eventually too. And so, yeah, it's cheap, it's easy, and a good way to start with the yogas. And really, the first part of the book on the yogas of the foundation yogas are my favorite. I also expanded on the moon yogas, a lot of the moon yogas, which are important for wealth. In another course I did called Concrete Chart and Varga Analysis with Jaimini, and in that I took a lot of these principles, these yoga principles of the moon that bear on wealth and how easy it is to obtain wealth. So if anyone wants to cover those, you know, a lot of those moon yogas better than I did in the book, because it was literally like, you know, 15, 20 years later of experience later, I cover those in greater detail in that that other course, which is a big predictive course.
Okay, brilliant. And what's the URL for your, you've got a couple of
really the best
websites,
place
right?
to go, the cheapest, by best I mean best and cheapest, is astrology-videos.com. Because there I've got all the videos of the last 6 years of teaching, plus I've put all the audios, all my old audios that I sell as a download, I've put on the site that you can listen to while you're logged into your membership. And so you can pay a membership fee of $30 a month and study everything as often as you want. By comparison, if you want to download a course, the average price is probably $60 a course, but you get one course, but you get to keep it for life. But a lot of the courses are better on video. And again, on the video site, you can listen to all my old audio courses too while you're logged in. You just can't download them and save them, you know? So unless you really want to own a copy of it that you have in 20 years, the video site's the better place to go. And a lot of the newer courses of the last 6 years are all on the video site in video. I have rendered most of the videos into audios that you can buy on download on the Vedic-astrology.net site. And so, you know, that's all there. So it just depends. But I recommend the video site. It's a cheap way to learn, you know?
Yeah, that's a brilliant model. And I haven't seen many astrologers doing that, to have, you know, a subscription service essentially for studying the videos and being able to watch the videos and basically learn from you.
Yes. And then they can join the studying group if you have questions. You know, so we have a lot of people asking questions and stuff throughout the day on what they're studying.
Excellent. And you've also been posting videos to YouTube for quite a while, right?
You know, I haven't hardly done any videos on YouTube in 2 years. I mean, just a handful. I try to do some videos here and there to let people know what I'm doing or working on or what's coming out, but I'm not having a lot of time. I've just been really busy teaching sites courses, because the last 3 years I've been teaching not only Vedic astrology courses on video, I've also been teaching card reading on video. And so I've created a whole new site for that, where I literally have a few hundred videos I've done in the last 2-3 years on that site. So between teaching on for videos for two sites, it's been hard to find any time for YouTube, really. But I do hope to do more YouTube, because I'm almost done with the card site. Card reading is only going to be a few hundred videos, not a few thousand as in astrology. And astrology is so vast. So I'll get back to doing some fun stuff on YouTube too.
Brilliant. Awesome. Well, yeah, I look forward to checking that out. And yeah, people should definitely check out your websites, which are Vedic-astrology.net. And then the other one is astrology-videos.com, right?
Yeah. And also I have another site if people want to get a free chart calculated. So a free Vedic chart with all the divisional charts, the way I would be calculating them, you can go to vaultoftheheavens.com.
Okay. And on that's your
yeah. And sorry, on that side, on the right-hand side, there's a chart that says free chart calculator in it. You click on that and you can get your chart. Your Vedic chart, so you can see what your Vedic chart looks like with the house cusp system I use. I use Companis house system, but again, I don't use them for boundaries. I just use them as points. So you'll get your basic Rashi chart, you know, with the sign, you know, house sign system, as you also, I think, use in the Hellenistic. Plus all the divisional charts and the dasha, the timing system, and the moon position and the nakshatra and things like that.
Okay.
Brilliant. Basically, you'll get what you need to start doing Vedic astrology for the first 6 months. So no one will have to buy a software until they really know if they want to pursue Vedic further.
And that's at vaultoftheheavens.com?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Awesome. Well, thanks a lot for joining me today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. It was great.
All right. And thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.